Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
So my proposal is that we should democratize the central bank, the Fed. We should change the whole structure, and the mandate is to engage in monetary policy, not just to bail out the banks, but to actually loan money, stimulate the economy more directly through a public bank structure at which the new Fed would sit at the apex of, but also engage as a public investment corporation. And its mandate would be for households and small businesses and so forth. So we need to democratize, and we need a public banking system, a national public banking system, not just state by state, and we need a national public investment corporation, and the Fed restructured can play those roles.
Now there's a mouthful of prospect right there. Dr. Jack Rasmus lays out where he thinks we need to go from here as the world's monetary system becomes increasingly dysfunctional from a people's perspective, as a result of being engorged with debt, resulting in the continuing slide of the common person's financial prospects at the hands of private speculators and hollow financial investments. Hello, and welcome once again to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today's program will give you a look into some of the emerging systemic elements that have everything to do with whether and how we might survive a likely coming credit crisis, which coincides with rising public economic distress around the U.S. and the world, as well as some promising responses to these conditions that are taking place around the U.S. and even in the U.S. Congress. Dr. Jack Rasmus is a noted author and professor of economics and politics. He's our guest and will lay out historical descriptions of the Fed and its role in creating and compounding our economic woes, and what needs to be done to make it more responsive to the real economy where people live rather than the world of what I like to call fantasy finance, a world of paper promises not tied to real economic value. Meanwhile, the people are not taking this deterioration of their plight sitting down. In France, in fact, they're in the streets by the scores of thousands demanding a new commitment to their economic well-being. That being sucked dry by debt, low wages, and high costs has gone far enough. And here in the U.S., we're seeing something similar in the rise of a public banking movement, not only in cities and states around the country, but now arriving in the halls of Congress as a new version of the highly successful FDR-era New Deal comes forward, demanding results for the people and the planet in the form of significant new green investment and a reconfiguration of the banking structure that moves our commonwealth continually into the coffers of only a few. One exciting and impressive new public response to this situation is arising powerfully in an African-American community north of Minneapolis, where almost 2,000 citizens have banded together to create a cooperative credit union focused on serving unique local needs in a highly personal and creative platform in a community underserved or misserved by established financial agencies. Our guest is Malia Conley of Village Trust Financial. You won't want to miss our conversation with her later in the program. We have a lot to get into today, so let's talk with Ellen about her new article, focused on how we can actually afford to create massive new investment into the people's economy.
Ellen, we're at the end of an exciting year in terms of our category of money, watching what's happening to it and who's managing it, what the systems and issues that are showing up around it. We've seen a lot of movement. The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates like crazy. We're in a different credit environment that way, and people are anticipating financial trouble in the near term. But among the other developments, a really exciting one from our view, I know, is that the election this past fall produced some pretty creative thinking and some pretty exciting results, as we talked about before, in Los Angeles, with a very powerful expression by the people of interest in having a public bank. And now in the new 17 representatives in the newly arriving Congress constituency in Washington, several of whom, now I guess all of them, supporting the idea of a Green New Deal. Your latest article outlines why this is not an outrageous idea. And builds on the question, but can we afford it? So what is the Green New Deal, and why is it that public banking could be so key in realizing these objectives?
Well, the Green New Deal obviously covers all those green things that we need, energy, transportation, et cetera. But they've also thrown in housing, health care, living wages, job guarantee, maybe a universal basic income. So pulling us out of poverty is one of the goals of the Green New Deal, like solving the problem of poverty. So critics dare not say we don't need to worry about the environment. So what they jump on is they say, well, everybody knows we can't afford that. It's not possible to solve all the world's problems in one fell swoop like that. But in fact, the way they are proposing to fund it is through the Federal Reserve and a public banking system, which is great. I mean, that's the first that anyone has introduced public banking as a solution to our crises at the federal level, other that I'm aware of.
Other than you.
You know, like in Congress, except Elizabeth Warren did push postal banking for a while. But other than that, they're pretty much quiet up there. So this is great that somebody's actually talking about it, and she's got a lot of support. And obviously, she's got the ear of the media. They love her in this. I mean, they love to criticize her, but she makes waves and she makes news and all that. So she's out there, and so they're paying attention. So public banking is, in that sense, in the news as a possible way to fund massive programs. Obviously, the Federal Reserve can fund anything it wants to. I mean, you'd have to tweak the Federal Reserve Act a bit because it's not currently allowed to make loans or to spend directly into the economy. But it's got the power. It's got the power to print. And you could just tweak the Federal Reserve Act a bit, which Congress wrote it. Congress could change it. Or we talked before, you could just have the Treasury issue some trillion-dollar coins. I mean, it's not at all impossible to get the money out there. The reason they don't do that always is that everybody is convinced that it would generate hyperinflation. But I would argue it wouldn't. First of all, a public banking system could fund all that sort of infrastructure, the green type infrastructure, not counting UBIs, but energy, transportation, housing, that sort of thing, where you're building something, you put the money out there, the thing you build generates fees or resources or rents or something that can then pay the money back. So the idea is you just put the money out there as credit, which is what all banks do. We now know they create the money they lend on their books. So you extend the credit, they build the thing, the loan gets paid back. That is how Roosevelt rebuilt the entire economy. I mean, I shouldn't say he did it, but that's how the original New Deal funded the rebuilding of the country in the 1930s at a time when everybody was broke. The banks were broke, I mean, literally bankrupt. And what they did was they went through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was not actually a bank. It was a publicly owned financial institution. It was independent enough that it wasn't Congress putting out the money, and it wasn't the Treasury. It was an independent bank, but owned by the government, which issued bonds and then made these loans for anything that would pay back. They made loans to farms and for dams and roads and all sorts of infrastructure all across the country, and rebuilt the country and turned a profit for the government. So not only did it not cost the taxpayers anything, it actually made money for the taxpayers. And then another famous instance would be the Transcontinental railroad.
Well, could we just take a look at how the Reconstruction Finance Corporation existed? It was brought into existence by Congress. Then they borrowed the money from the U.S. Treasury, right?
Yeah, they issued bonds, which the Treasury bought. And then the question is, where did the Treasury get the money? They assume they went into debt. I mean, it has been said that we had a worse debt-to-GDP ratio during World War II. It also funded World War II. So debt was high, but GDP caught up to it. So the thing was paid off later. But so I assume they went into debt initially, and then the proceeds of the loans paid those bonds back.
And built a lot of profit and made more loans. That's the model of the public bank, too, that we're talking about.
Right.
And so presumably the Green New Deal public bank structure or network that's being proposed would be funded by the Treasury and get its start that way. What do they envision of how that relationship works? And are they talking about one bank or several banks?
Well, that's a good question. They're pretty vague, but it says a new public bank or system of regional and specialized public banks, public venture funds, and such other vehicles or structures, etc. So it will be primarily come from the federal government using a combination of the Fed, a new public bank, or system of regional and specialized public banks. So it sounds like it could be a network of public banks headed by a nationalized Federal Reserve, which is the proposal of Jack Rasmus, who I just interviewed for this show, or it could be a public infrastructure bank. There are two possibilities. Whether they're talking about a depository bank is not clear. It could be what we've been talking about on the Bank of North Dakota model, where it takes public deposits and then leverages capital using the deposits to make loans, or it could just be a revolving fund, which is what is often what is talked about when they say infrastructure bank.
So it seems like the people are closing in on the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury insofar as there are these new ideas emerging. One of our guests on the show today is Malia Connolly of the Village Trust Finance, north of Minneapolis, a black-owned credit union that's focused specifically on giving loans into that community. A very exciting new development. I think we were both impressed with how well it's put together. But again, you know, we see that on the local level and on the national level with this New Deal demand for, hey, let's fix this stuff. We need some money. And as you say in your article, we don't have enough money. You've been saying that for quite a while. Well, the bottom line here is that people's needs are not being met. There are a lot of people who are out of the flow, and it's a downward slide for the public well-being, welfare, and something has to change. So we're at this time now where there are new understandings, and I think your article is a great opener for that. Funding a Green New Deal with public banks, all these ideas and theories are leading to some sort of an exciting prospect for next year. We're going to see how the Green New Deal shows up in Congress. Obviously, I think the public bank conversation is coming into more a common understanding, and apparently now will be in a center stage as we look at how to make this economy work for the people, as opposed to the banking cartel and industry that has been taking advantage of folks for so long. We're going to have to leave it there for the moment, Ellen, and get on with our guests, but to be continued.
Yes, always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of a number of books, including his latest titled Central Bankers at the End of Their Rope? He has another book coming out in March titled Alexander Hamilton and the Origins of the Fed. Hi, Jack. It's great getting to talk to you.
My pleasure to be here.
So you're a wealth of knowledge on central banking, the history of central banking, and what it's up to right now. You ended your current book with a question mark. So what do you think? Are central bankers at the end of their rope?
Yes, I think they are. Exactly when remains to be determined, of course. Central bankers you know, in 2008 and 2009, bailed out the banking system by tens of trillions of dollars globally. And as I've been arguing in that book, Central Bank is the End of the Rope, and my preceding book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, that bailout, that massive excess liquidity injection, as a solution, is also the source of the next problem and the next crisis. So the solution is the problem. The problem is the solution, according to central bankers. This has been the issue ever since the collapse of the Bretton Woods Agreement in the 1970s. Central banks were given the task of managing liquidity, and they've blown that management function terribly ever since. And they've been creating financial bubbles by the excess liquidity that leads to the excess debt and leveraging and the ballooning of financial asset markets. And they create these crises, these financial bubbles in the crises. And then the solution to the crises is to inject even more liquidity. So the solution is the problem.
And it seems to me that does have to come to an end at some point, and we're pretty much there if you consider the amount of global debt and the fact that historically what they do is when there's a crisis, then they drop rates, interest rates down to nearly zero or very low, and then that's supposed to get people borrowing again, which gets the economy moving again, but that just hasn't really worked lately, and now they dare not raise rates because so many businesses, people, governments are so heavily in debt that if you increase rates, you'll just collapse the whole system. So you had also mentioned that our president is looking with disfavor on the central bank, although he actually appointed head of the Fed. But what do you think of the chances of actually curbing some of their historical independence? Or where did they get their independence in the first place? Why did they think they should be independent, and how have they gotten away with that?
Yes, well, this whole central bank independent myth, as I call it, is really a product of recent decades. You know, I mean, it was never really considered an issue. When the Fed was formed in 1913, it was totally run and dominated by private bankers. They elected themselves to the district committees, and the big banks of New York, Philadelphia, and elsewhere really had their district that had exclusive rights dealing with foreign banks and so forth that they wanted. That was the New York Fed, the district among districts. and they were staffed all by private bankers, you see. And there was no issue about independence from the private banking system. The Fed in its initial decades was considered okay to be run by the bankers. And that was a product of the 1907 crash and epic recession that followed, where the private bankers could barely bail out the private bank crash that occurred in 1907-08. The economy had gotten too large, and unlike during the late 19th century, they couldn't pool enough resources to bail themselves out, so the government had to come in. The Treasury expended nearly all its liquid assets to bail out the banks in 1907-08, and it was decided that, you know, they needed an institution that would bail themselves out. They couldn't do it themselves anymore, and hence that's how we got the Federal Reserve. And the Fed failed terribly in the 1920s and early 30s even in dealing with the instability. First, it fed the bubbles of the 1920s that ended up with the stock market crash and then four banking crashes in the early 30s. And the result was major reforms in 1935, in which the total control of the Fed by private bankers was checked to some extent. And that's when we got the governors, the seven governors of the Fed, injecting some more central government influence into, you know, the decision making of the Fed. And there was no discussion at that time of you know, that the Fed should be independent. You know, it had screwed up terribly, so why should it be left independent? And it's only when the Fed began to come out of the corner, you know, and Roosevelt and others put it in the corner there and let the Treasury run central banking functions pretty much until the early 1950s, and the Federal Reserve was allowed to come out and play a larger role, monetary policy. by the 1960s. And then that role was given significant further authority when we had the collapse of the Bretton Woods Agreement and Smithsonian Agreement in early 1970s, and what we call the managed float of the global economy, managed by the central banks, with the Fed as the central bank of central banks, because of the dollar is the global currency. And once that happened, the collapse of Bretton Woods, the central banks led by the Fed started engaging in this long-run massive liquidity put, as they call it, just injecting more and more liquidity into the system. And the system began to change as a result of that massive liquidity, I argue, and it became more financialized, you see, and more dependent on debt. And not just debt used for financing real asset investment, meaning equipment and buildings and structures investment, but increasingly over time, financial assets. All this growth of financial securities is, I argue, the consequence in the last decades, the consequence of all this excess liquidity. There's more liquidity out there than is needed to invest in real assets. So this structure of highly liquid financial asset markets globally began to arise, and a new global finance capital elite dedicated to moving its money around in these financial asset markets began to rise with it. And the cap, as they call the capital markets and the shadow banks and all that, are ultimately a consequence of this massive liquidity put by the central banks.
I'm still not clear how the central bank actually gets the money out there. I mean, I can see where if they drop interest rates to zero, I mean, 95% of the money supply is created by banks when they make loans, right? It's not created by the central bank. The central bank creates reserves that go to other banks, but they do not go into the real economy. That's why there's $2.2 trillion in reserves sitting on bank balance sheets. They are making 2.2% interest on it, which is a good interest rate, so you can see why they just let it sit there. But theoretically, you know, if they could lend it at 10%, they'd still rather lend, but they don't because it can't jump from there into the real economy. Anyway, so I can see where lowering interest rates to zero, which they would do to try to stimulate the economy, would encourage all sorts of speculative investment.
Partly well, where did the banks that borrowed from the Fed when their reserves were increased, where did they lend the money? Well, they initially loaned it to other shadow banks and other investors, and to some extent to other companies that were expanding in emerging markets. You see, a lot of the money went out into emerging markets, into real investment in emerging markets, as well as financial asset investment globally. Well, that didn't help the U.S. economy at all. You know, that helped Brazil and China and all these others that immediately expanded after the 2009-10 you know, crash there, the bottom of the crash, they immediately expanded. So what you got is commercial banks lending to capital markets and to shadow banks and private investors, and the money flowing out globally to emerging markets. That's what happened after 2009.
So what do you think? Is Trump going to curb the independence of the Fed? And it seems to me that Japan is actually doing it right with Abenomics, where they are not only doing quantitative easing, buying up the debt of the government and holding it on the central bank's balance sheet, which I think is a good thing because it's basically interest free. And if you don't turn it back into the market, it's basically free money. You know, you're taking back that, you're voiding out that debt, and then the government can spend more. But so at the same time, they're doing fiscal stimulus. So the government is spending money, like not the central bank. The central bank is the one that's dealing with the government's debt, and then the government itself is putting money into the economy. It seems to me that would be the right thing to do. And Trump actually is spending, and everybody is shocked at what our budget is going up to. But it seems to me that that would work if the central bank pulled the bonds back and held them on the books of the bank so that they were basically not in the system, you know, not accumulating interest and not hitting the debt ceiling.
Well, the problem with the Bank of Japan is that it's not just It's not just sovereign bonds that are involved here. The bank is buying up corporate bonds and buying up stocks, equities. You see, it's propping. The Bank of Japan is the extreme example. It's the origin of QE, by the way. It was the Japanese that came up with that idea. And it's buying up equities. It's propping up, you know, the demand from the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, is propping up the financial markets in Japan, including the equity markets. And in buying up all of the bonds, corporate bonds and so forth, you know, it's a problem. And the spending, the fiscal spending, you know, by the government in Japan, yes, but they raise taxes too, so they're taking out.
Yeah, defeats the purpose, right?
Yeah, it defeats the purpose. And the fundamental problem here is that real asset investment, right, the multiplier effect, and this is true with government spending, the multiplier effect has declined in real investment. In other words, government spending does not generate as much GDP and further economic activity as it used to. The multipliers, I believe, are less than one.
And why is that?
I believe it's less than one because of the massive debt overhang everywhere in the economy and society, both government and households and business and everything. And that massive debt is because, again, you go back to all the excess financial asset investment that's been going on. So we got a problem that real interest rates do not generate real investment as much as it used to. That's a problem. And we have a problem that the multiplier from real investment has seriously weakened. Right? So that government spending, especially defense spending, you see, defense spending is not very labor intensive anymore. These are, you know, high technology kind of spending. We're not building thousands of airplanes and tanks and so forth. Not enough of it gets into the consumption, you know, through employment and so forth into consumption. And, of course, the tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts, are having very little effect. They're pretty much dissipated already because why? Those who are getting the tax cuts, the investors, so forth, are plowing, and corporations are plowing it into stock buybacks and dividend payouts and offshore and so forth. It's this problem, again, of the financial structure. So government
injections.
Well, and
that's a problem because they don't have customers, so they're not going to expand their business if the people don't have the money to spend.
Exactly.
They need to get the money into the hands of the ordinary
people. But that's the problem when you put monetary policy first. You see, that's what the Fed did in 2008 and 2009. They had decided, not just the Fed alone, of course, but the elites had decided that they were going to stimulate a recovery through monetary policy, you know, excessive low chronic interest rates, and that would recover the banking system, and the banks would then loan the money out, stimulate into the real economy, stimulate real investment, and that would trickle down, and you would get more employment and more consumption. In other words, it was a top-down attempt to re-stimulate the economy, but it took so long because it was top-down monetary policy first. And that's why you get austerity fiscal policy. That means you're not going to stimulate the economy from the bottom up. You're going to do it from the top down with monetary policy. But because of these reasons I talked about,
that could work if you actually dropped it in the pockets of the people, like Bernanke was talking about in 2002. But that's not what they do. They drop it in the pockets of the banks.
That's right. And the banks either hoarded it or loaned it offshore, or loaned it to investors and corporations that invested in financial asset markets. You see, it did not get where it was supposed to go.
Right.
And that's why we had this chronic slow to no growth that left, you know, huge swaths of the population, households and consumers, in debt and behind. And now you're seeing you know, the consequences of that. We saw it with the Trump election in 2016, and right in front of our eyes, we're seeing it with UK Brexit and now with Macron in France. This whole policy of the recovery is now having its consequences because you've got huge amounts of percentage of households who haven't really recovered here. They're underemployed. Wages have not really risen. They've risen at the top. top 10%. They're skewed to the top. And it looks like wages are rising 3%, but they're not for the massive middle America.
Well, I would like to get to your solutions. I know you're suggesting a constitutional amendment concerning the central bank, and you've mentioned a national public bank and a public investment bank, democratizing the Fed. Do you want to go into all that?
Yeah, it's really interesting that in a so-called democracy, you have an institution, the central bank, which is pretty much shielded from any accountability, you see, to the people. You know, fiscal policy is determined by elected legislature, and you can, you know, affect that by voting and so forth. But you've got monetary policy totally shielded, pretty much, except for a few heads of banking committees and so forth in Congress, from the effects it has, tremendous effects, and we just discussed these tremendous effects on the populace. Seems to me that monetary policy in the central bank should be democratically accountable, just as fiscal policy and legislatures are accountable. Right. So my proposal is that we should democratize the central bank, the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
We should
change
the whole structure and have the heads, you know, a new national committee of five. Four districts. You know, my proposal is to reduce the 12 districts to four districts, and to ensure that the mandate is to engage in monetary policy, not just to bail out the banks, not just to stimulate the economy through interest rates, but to actually loan money and stimulate the economy more directly through a structure of a private, a public bank structure at which the new Fed would sit at the apex of, but also it would also engage in as a public investment corporation, and its mandate would be for households and small businesses and so forth, not just bail out the banks, because that's what the Fed is there for, primarily to bail out the banks, lender of last resort. It has some other functions as well, but that's the primary function. That's why it was created in 1913, and it does that well, but at the expense of everybody else. So we need to democratize and have these Fed governors elected according to, a structure of districts, a new structure. And we need a public banking system, a national public banking system, not just state by state. And we need a national public investment corporation. And the Fed restructured can play those roles, in my opinion, and should play those roles.
Well, there are proposals on the table now for a digital currency. In other words, the Federal Reserve their reserves would basically be dollars, and everybody could participate. Like, people could bank at the central bank or through your local public bank that was, like you said, connected or over part of the central banking system. So you would never have liquidity problems. And I mean, the central bank can't run out of money, but the people would actually get to participate in all that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we'll eventually move to digital currency. The Fed, the central banks are very dubious of it because it will weaken their control over regulating the currency if it's totally digital out there. That's why the central banks are now regulating and starting to tax the cryptocurrencies. They see it as a threat. But those would be
private. But I'm thinking of a public. In other words, digital dollars that were actually issued by the Federal Reserve. So you could take your bank-created dollars, deposit them in your central bank system, and what you would get would be real legal tender and not just a promise to pay in legal tender.
But the limitation of that, you see, is, once again, to the other point I made earlier, you can provide all the liquidity you want, right? But if there isn't a demand for the money, which is based upon real economic conditions, it doesn't matter how much or in what form a central bank or the government provides money supply, liquidity. You've got to have the real conditions, and the real conditions have to do with living standards and income growth, real income growth, not debt-based income growth, which is, you know, we got consumption based primarily on debt now instead of real growth and real income. That's both on the corporate and the household side. You've got to have real income growth in order to put the two pieces together, the supply of money and the demand of money, you see. And we really have a problem with this real income growth issue because of the labor markets. The labor markets have been radically changed as well, and increasingly we have people who are underemployed. You know, my estimate is probably 40, 50 million people out there are underemployed, even more in Europe. And until you do something about that, because underemployed means insufficient income, and, of course, we got the new artificial intelligence coming. McKinsey consultants estimate that 30% of occupations will be negatively impacted by 2025 as a result of artificial intelligence eliminating all kinds of jobs. So this problem on the labor markets, on the demand side, the demand for money, is going to get worse. And there seems to be no solution for that.
Well, a universal basic income that would be issued by the central bank from its deep pocket as a digital currency would be easy to do. You just put it in people's bank accounts.
Yeah, it would be easy to do, but it's a political problem. You got political interests in this country that are adamantly opposed to any kind of universal income. You know, it's a political problem. It's not a technical problem, as you say. You could do it, but it's a political problem, and that's not on the horizon. Having a UBI, universal basic income. But it's going to be a big issue by the middle of the next decade.
Yeah. So what's your prognosis for the economy, and do we have to wait like for the next crash before anything's going to get changed, you know, before we could implement any of these great ideas that we all have about how to fix things?
Well, I've been arguing for the past year, and you know, publicly in writing and so forth, that the Fed cannot raise the federal funds rate more than 2.75 or 3% without causing a credit crunch and a recession. And of course, we're darn close to that now. I've been arguing that December will be the last Fed rate hike, maybe one more in March, but you know, a year ago when everyone was saying, oh, four more hikes this year, four more next year, I would say, no, they'll never even get close because the economy is too fragile because of the debt overlay. You know, I think we're heading, I've been projecting second half of 2019, we're going to have a recession here. And globally, you see countries falling into it right and left. And there's no way the U.S. is going to be able to avoid a recession, particularly if the Fed overestimates and continues raising rates. If it raises rates beyond December, I think we're going to get close to that. And the markets are kind of saying that, too, I think. So my prediction is a recession in 2019. When you have a recession, financial asset prices collapse. They're already beginning to contract. You see it in stock markets here, just sort of churning, ready to take a big dive. We see this financial asset price retreat beginning to occur. Now, when you hit a recession and you have financial asset price collapse, then that massive debt overlay that's been built up cannot be serviced. In other words, principal and interest cannot be serviced. And then you have a crisis because then you start having defaults and so forth.
Right.
And companies like GE and Deutsche Bank, they're already at the very edge of this. You know, they're very, very shaky. So I don't know how the contagion mechanism is going to actually play out here in financial asset markets. But if we have a recession, you're going to see financial assets drop even faster, which means real debt will rise, increase problems of financing that debt, which means defaults, and now you have a big psychological effect on investing, and it begins to contract across the board.
Mm-hmm.
I see that late 2019 beginning and 2020 definitely occurring.
Do you want to tell people where they can find your books and your writings and reach you generally?
Yes, you know, I have a blog, jackrasmus.com, jackrasmus.com. You know, my Twitter account at drjackrasmus. My website is kyklosproductions.com, losproductions.com, where my radio and TV interviews are all posted. And I have a weekly radio show called Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network. As you had indicated, the next book coming out is a prequel to Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. It's Alexander Hamilton, The Origins of the Fed. It's kind of about the evolution of the U.S. banking system.
Well, it's great talking to you, and good luck with your new books. They sound very interesting.
Well, my pleasure being here.
That's Dr. Jack Rasmus, Ellen Brown's guest on It's Our Money. Systemic abuse of African Americans is well known to apply across the spectrum of our social and cultural landscape, and the world of banking and finance is a key element of how those conditions have been perpetuated. From redlining of neighborhoods by mortgage companies, to higher fees for credit, to a lack of banking services that are endemic to these neighborhoods, which result in a lack of economic infrastructure of services, the list is very long. But now, a creative and promising new effort has taken hold on the north side of Minneapolis, which represents a new model of community financial potential and response, a cooperative credit union designed to enable and support local citizen involvement and investment and benefit from the shared power of resources and an abiding commitment to see neighbors succeed and resources nurtured. Our guest is Malia Connolly, Village Financial Director of Vision and Strategy. In the face of recent tragic killings of black citizens by police in Minneapolis, Malia took action to protect what she saw was the threat to the future of her community and fellow African Americans in the form of economic resistance, resulting in an impressive new economic engine.
I created an event on social media to invite people to start talking about economic resistance. And I created an organization in 2016, July, called Blexit. And it was all around economic resistance, organized boycotting with an invest-divest approach. We had almost 200 community members show up that night. And it was through a process of voting and small group discussion and debate that we came up with a handful of primary campaign ideas. And the number one idea in the room that night that had over double the votes of anything else was to establish a black-led financial institution on the north side of Minneapolis. And so that really was the beginning of what Village Financial Cooperative is today. It was, you know, in a moment of, you know, really severe grief and sadness and frustration coming from black community members who were experiencing yet another police killing, someone in our community. They had the clarity of mind to say that they knew that the root to all of these inequities was economic institutional power.
So Village Financial Cooperative is a credit union, is that correct?
It's an emerging credit union. We have submitted our application to the Minnesota Department of Commerce. So we're expecting any day now to have that charter approved, and then we'll be waiting for approval from the NCUA, which is the equivalent of FDIC for insurance. So we are an emerging black-led credit union. Right now we operate as a nonprofit agency. We created an organization called the Association for Black Economic Power to really hold the operations until the credit union had all of its, you know, regulatory permissions and the charter and the insurance, et cetera. And really, really powerful to see how many community members came together. A typical credit union startup has about 600 pledged members. So those are folks that come to the table and say, yes, when you open, this is the amount of money I'm going to move to your institution, and this is how much my average balance, you know, every month will be. That's about 600 members. We have about 1,600, and that reflects about $4.2 million of pledged deposits, the majority of those coming from black folks from the north side.
Meantime, you're a revolving fund, is that right? You're making loans already?
Exactly. Yeah, we actually found that as we started taking pledges, we were surveying members. And it was a Friday night that I got a text message from a pledged member who said that she was in line at Walmart, waiting to get her check cashed, and in line with 60 other black people. And they were asking, you know, when is Village going to be open? Mm-hmm. And our response to that was, you don't need a charter to address these needs. The primary financial institution on the north side of Minneapolis, which, by the way, is the primary black neighborhood that's been redlined historically for black folks, and has the highest, you know, levels of being underserved and unserved, underbanked and unbanked, et cetera. And so the primary financial institution are payday lenders and check cashers. And so those are the spaces that folks have access to. And so, you know, the issue of predatory lending becoming a crippling situation for black community members here is very prominent, and we wanted to address that. So we created an alternative to payday loans called the New Day Loan. It's up to $500, 0 to 8% interest with flexible terms. And we also have a startup cooperative loan for black folks that would like to start cooperative businesses. And we do a product that we call cashless check cashing, where we leverage fintech to be able to cash checks for folks that need access to them without an additional charge. The interest rate is 0 to 8%. I believe the majority of our loans are zero. So this product is more of a membership product that we use. It's not a money maker, but it really is focusing on what cooperatives are supposed to do, which is focus on people, not profit. And so we developed the loan pool out of PRIs and out of grant dollars, and we started in June, and as of today, we have a 100% repayment rate.
Wow, that is great. You don't have defaults. What if you did have defaults? It doesn't matter because you're taking, you got the money as donations in the first place?
Yeah, we also have a loan loss reserve fund to cover if, in case there are defaults. But I think the important thing to note is the only other CDFI or financial institution in the state that was doing consumer lending on this level was the White Earth Investment Initiative on the White Earth Reservation. And we went there and researched with their director and really shadowed them for quite some time and studied their program, which had become wildly successful. And they had less than 1% default rate for their lending, and their lending pool had grown to over $1 million. What was interesting is that folks of color, Indigenous and Native folks and black people have been slated by traditional financial institutions as a riskier lending pool. And the statistics simply show that that is not true. If we provide equitable products and services, and that if there is a relationship built into that transaction, it's not just a transactional relationship, but there's actual background and connection and assistance and advocacy built in, then the repayment rate is actually better than the typical traditional banking statistics and ratios. So when we saw their success, we decided to model the New Day Loan after their consumer loan. And so we walked in kind of knowing that there were comps available in other places in our state and also throughout the country. And so we're hoping that that word gets out to other CDFIs and other financial institutions that have been skittish to provide this type of consumer loan to folks who really, really need it.
Wow, that is great. I know they started out with cooperative banks in the Middle Ages in Europe, but the reason they wound up charging interest was that some people didn't pay the loans back, and then eventually they went insolvent. So they had to charge something in order to cover the losses. But I can see where in a community where you know the people and you trust the people, there's a lot more motivation to make sure the loan gets repaid.
I do think that historically there are issues around repayment, but I think in our situation, making sure that there's relationship, making sure that, you know, in our institution, we have removed the word deny. And so we've made the commitment that we don't have the same experience for our members, our pledged members, when they come in the door. The options aren't either you get approved or you get denied. And I think that that stigma really shuts the door of building a relationship. With Village, when you apply for a loan or for credit, you either get approved or you get a plan. And what that does is it sends the message that we're connected and we're committed to the long term of walking with our pledged members through the pathway towards their financial goals, and that even if that particular loan at that particular time isn't right for them and would actually make their financial situation worse, which is the circumstance of which we wouldn't approve, you know, we're also going to make sure that we design a plan to get them to where they're trying to go. And I think that language and that type of narrative changes the dynamics of the relationship from, you know, a debtor to a collector to someone that's an advocate for you, someone that's looking out for you and is committed to making sure that they help you achieve your goals.
Well, that's great, like family.
That's,
well, you know, you're always going to see him too, right? You know, that's
right,
one
right.
thing.
You know where to find him.
Exactly.
It reminds me very much of the German banks that we often refer to in public banking, the Sparkassen, who all stick with their customers to see that they're successful. Do you know, are you the only one of your type in the country?
I think the only one that was similar was an LGBTQ credit union out of Seattle, and I don't know whether or not they're still on track. I believe they had some issues with financing. As you know, this market, credit unions and the financial sector, it's consolidating, and so it's very difficult for a startup. You know, in our state, our work towards having a state charter, no one in our Department of Commerce has ever chartered a new credit union. I mean, it's so rare that they haven't done it in 10 years, and the entire staff that's there has never gone through that process. So this has been a learning process, not only for us, but also for our regulators. And so, yes, we are a little bit of an anomaly, but we're also seeing a lot of other efforts across the country and across the world. We've been reached out by folks out of Boston, folks out of Wisconsin, even folks out of London who are interested in developing credit unions. And similar to our model. And so we're energized and excited to be leading that pathway and, you know, beating that path again, something that historically Black folks have done since the early 1900s. And so we know we're not anything new, but it definitely is time for us to start reimagining the financial sector and reclaiming the commons in this way. So we're excited to be able to lead the charge in that.
Giving very small loans to people who don't have any collateral, is that an aspect, a dimension of what your loans are about?
It is. I mean, you'd be surprised how much a $500 to $2,000 loan does for everyday people that are just trying to make ends meet between checks. And so microloans is really important. The New Day loan is a type of consumer microloan. Like I mentioned, we also have startup loans for startup cooperatives. And that loan is up to $5,000. And so these are really small dollar loans that aren't typically managed by traditional financial institutions. They usually would have touched something that small or market that. But we know that our community is asking for this level of credit and this level of access to loan dollars. And so we want to make sure that we're responding to what's actually being asked and not just, you know, focusing on what's popular in the industry right now.
Do you have any thoughts about investing in local properties for residential development projects?
You know, I think the issue in North Minneapolis, and which is the same as a lot of other urban cities and urban hubs, is gentrification. And the history in Minnesota, which is the second worst state in the country for Black people, is that gentrification and the racist practice of eminent domain has really crippled our communities. And obviously, you know, the subprime mortgage, you know, instance of bringing the economy down really devastated Black community and removed a lot of generational wealth from, you know, our families. And so when we talk about investment, it's really important that we try to be more creative with the approach. And so making sure that in the future we're looking towards owning land, not only within the urban hub, but also making that connection to rural spaces, and making sure that Black folks also have ownership in rural areas as well, we think is important and something that we want to look towards once the credit union is up and running and stable. There's also the interest of land trust. And I think that most people don't know that it was Black farmers in the South that actually created the agency of land trust for the purpose of protecting our land property. Land has been stripped from our communities historically since after slavery, and that has been done systemically and intentionally to remove wealth from our communities. So making sure that we reestablish the practice of creating land trusts, not just residential, but commercial as well, is important. I think replicating capitalistic methods of wealth building doesn't necessarily work in the same way for Black communities as it does for more privileged communities like white communities. We don't have the safety net. We don't have the protections of generational wealth. We don't have the networks of people in powerful positions that we can flex our rates. We're actually putting ourselves in a position where we're paying the highest prices for vendors, the highest prices for entry into certain markets and industries. And so when we create land trusts, when we create cooperatives, it helps to insulate our economic communities. It helps to insulate our families because we're able to pool our resources together and share the risk. When we do this alone, whether it's property ownership or whether it's taking out loans, we become more vulnerable as individuals, and it really goes against our cultural norms of working together and pulling together. So we're interested in those elements of buying property, of having a different strategy on how we hold property and mm-hmm. protecting that property in a different way. But obviously, our first and main goal is to really stay in our lane and establish, our prominence as a credit union, and more share that vision with community members who might want to take up the charge in some of these other investment areas.
It's really inspiring. You're really doing some groundbreaking work there.
Do you have any collaboration or any relationships with Black bankers from around the country who are aware of you and participating with you?
Yeah, we're actually a part of an association called Bank Black. And that is an association. It's an app as well that's really trying to get the word out around moving your money to Black-owned banks and credit unions. So we know that Village will be on that listserv and will be, working in alignment with other established Black banks. As an emerging credit union, it's difficult to really collaborate on products and services and research, market research, et cetera. So we're waiting until we're up and running to really become more active in that space. But we know that, we're all facing the same, the same circumstances. We have small banks and credit unions that are facing the same levels of regulation and requirements that a lot of large banks are facing, and that means that we have to invest a significant amount of resources toward, software and making sure that regulation is being followed, et cetera, instead of making sure that those resources are going toward making sure there's velocity, circulation of wealth in the community. And so we're really interested in talking about how do we change regulation around cooperative economic institutions and creating regulation that actually makes sense for us and our business model, which is, we have businesses that have a B Corp and those types of things that create this added benefit that, corporations are adding these types of community benefit elements to their work. Well, cooperatives come built in with tons of community benefit because of the cooperative principles and values. So we really want to start to educate our leaders here in our state and also in the capital in D.C. to help them understand that these institutions are actually beneficial to everyone, whether we're talking about cooperative banks or we're talking about cooperative food systems, cooperative health care. They are baked in to help community around them to create equity and to create power for local communities. And so we should have a different set of regulation for that type of business. And we're really excited that Ilhan Omar was just elected to go to the Capitol, and we're hoping that she'll take that message along with her.
Wow. A case has been made that those regulations were put in place in order to force the small banks out of business because only the big banks have the ability to meet them.
Well, I presume that you're still accepting pledges, yes?
We absolutely are accepting pledges. We're 1,600 strong, like I mentioned, but our goal is to get to 5,000 at our grand opening. We're slated to open Juneteenth of 2019, and all signs mark towards us being on track for that goal. So in the meantime, anyone who lives, works, or worships in Hennepin or Ramsey County in the state of Minnesota can pledge to become a member at www.villagefinancial.org. And anyone else that wants to support our effort can go to our website and leave a donation. And feel free to leave us an email, a kind note, any tips that you have for us. If you've started a credit union before, we'd love to hear it. And any encouraging words would go a long way. We're pushing towards reaching this goal, and it's been trying, but it's been incredibly inspiring. But we continue to want to stay involved and stay connected to folks who are watching this journey and as we travel it.
Well, thank you so much, Malia, for this great work that you're doing and for sharing some of this insight to us.
That's Malia Conley of Village Financial. You can read more about their project in this month's edition of Yes Magazine. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.